Hello and welcome to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And in this edition of the podcast, I talked to Wendy Alexander, Vice Principal International at the University of Dundee, about her remarkable career, the university's international activities, student life after the pandemic, and the future direction of higher education in Scotland and the UK. Wendy's career has taken her around many parts of the world, both as a student and in work, but it's always had a connection with higher education one way or another. That consistent thread of 8 years run through a period of international consultancy, 12 years in and around the Scottish Parliament, including a period as leader of Scottish Labour, and more recently as a higher education trade envoy for the Scottish Government. Exploring her current role at Dundee, we learn about the development of the university's international activities over the past decade, the growth in student numbers, partnerships in a range of disciplines with universities in Singapore and China, including a visit to Wuhan in early 2020, and a strong and comprehensive programme of humanitarian scholarships for students from the most challenged of circumstances around the world. Considering the need for that humanitarian approach, especially with the potential for welcoming students from Ukraine, we consider the importance of laying the foundations for those recruits, recognising that sorting out all the details can take time, and visa arrangements in particular. We discuss the changed nature of the student experience and their expectations in a post-pandemic world, and the importance of student unions and related activities to create a real sense of belonging. And note that unions and universities really do need to work together to provide the right support and resources for students. Finally, we explore the potential for further divergence of higher education policies across the nations of the UK, and Wendy suggests there will be more points of connection, as well as perhaps some further divergence, given that higher education is one of Britain's few global assets. It's a great conversation with a very old friend, and I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, and this time it's my incredible pleasure to speak to Wendy Alexander. Wendy is Vice Principal International at the University of Dundee. Welcome, Wendy. Great to see you after many, many years.
Good afternoon. It is a long while. I could date both of us, but I suspect 40 when we first met. There you are, or getting close to it.
It's a very, very long time ago. So we will skip gaily over those student years. But I do want to know how you ended up at the VP role at Dundee, because, you know, you've been in a whole host of both political as well as higher education and other business roles as well. So, I mean, it's a really interesting trajectory. So imagine you're not at a dinner party, right? How do you articulate your career journey? It's not an interview really either. I'm just really interested about how you describe it, because it's extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, of course, everyone makes sense of their kind of career journey in retrospect. So I will now say, of course, that the red thread through it all was international education. So I've ended where I began, and you will not remember, but even before I knew you, I had studied in Canada for a couple of years, an international student at the very end of schooling. And so I suppose in the first 20 years of my career, I spent 10 of them outside of Scotland. And that was living in Canada, studying in the US, working in Africa, studying in France, working in Brussels, then in consultancy, working in Asia. So, you know, I was have passport like to travel. And they were all the years up until 97. And as you know, I had a long association with the Labour Party, and with spectacularly bad judgment when I thought there was no prospect of us winning again after, you know, kind of four election defeats, I went off to INSEAD and decided I was much happier to be a business person, and then spent some time in international consultancy. But it has to be said, on the 1st of May 97, when Labour got elected, it sounded quite fun to be part of it. So I became a special advisor to the Labour government. And then I thought, if we're going to have the first Scottish Parliament in 300 years, it would be nice to be there. So I had a kind of dozen year sojourn in politics, doing various interesting things there, including having the higher education portfolio and briefly leading at Labour in the Scottish Parliament. But you recall I'd lived in Canada, and I'd seen the first Quebec referendum And I rather thought that Scotland was going to spend the next 20 years deciding whether it was going to stay or go. And since I didn't want to have the same argument for the next 20 years, I decided to go back to higher education. I went to London Business School. I ran their global operations. I then came to Dundee, Vice Principal International there. I still have a slight kind of toehold on the government side. I act as the higher education trade envoy for the Scottish Government, and I still hanker after business. So I chair the advisory board for Times Higher Education, looking at how edtech platforms can make a huge difference to the international student experience. So that's the kind of that's the trajectory. And I suppose the one thing I'd say is, why do I do it? Because, you know, it is ideas that really change the world. Even when the years I was in politics, I was a visiting professor, and in my spare time would be kind of writing scholarship, I think it would be said, rather than proper research, about the issues of the issues of the day. But there's always been that kind of hankering for the international side of things.
That's a great summary. And I think that you, yeah, that is coherent, right? And not that I was going to suggest that it wasn't, but it does all link together. And I hadn't thought of it quite that way. So that, but it does point out that it is actually extraordinary. I think that is a remarkable trajectory. So on that international side then, I mean, Dundee is quite an international university. It's had a long standing, engagement with Singapore in particular, hasn't it? And it is a real outwardly looking institution. So have you felt that you've been able to kind of enhance that in your time there?
So I often say my job is to make the institution solvent while much more worthy people than me cure malaria, because what we're known for is we're really, really good at life sciences. And, yeah. and there is a kernel of truth in that. I talked about the years I'd spent in business. I'm also a good Scottish Presbyterian. I actually think balancing the books is the right thing. And having worked in government, I appreciate that there is always a better call on the public pound. There's always going to be, can we get 4-hour waiting times, or are we got enough police in our streets, or whatever. So really, when I came to Dundee, it has a fantastic access mission in terms of learning and teaching and student experience. But its global posture was really around the research work it did. And it had, if you will, missed the boat in many ways on the internationalisation of the student community. I mean, obviously, Nottingham was at the polar opposite end of that. And it was, so the mission was really in the first few years, how do we create a global campus and a global student population? And I suppose we've done three things of significance. The first one is to quadruple our international fee income over the last just slightly under a decade. It was a low base to start with, but really getting a proper engine of international growth going that made it possible for a non-Russell Group research intensive university to continue to invest in world-changing research. The second thing was, how do we create a number of really important partnerships? And you alluded to Singapore. Well, of course, the answer is always to take your best to the world. So we took the life scientists to Singapore. And one of the things that was really interesting there was, why was the National University of Singapore, NUS, why on earth, it was at the time top in Asia. Why on earth, obviously the Chinese have slightly overtaken since, why on earth would they partner with these little guys on the east coast of Scotland? And the answer was because from their exchange scheme, their exchange students said they had the best experience at Dundee, bar none. And I don't see this as a Dundee point. I think it is as a UK point. And it is because in their what we would have called the senior honours year, in their final year, students get to be in labs. They get to practice. They get to figure out what it would be like to have a research and a doctoral career, which in a big Asian university with less labs and a much more rote learning approach wasn't possible. So we managed to build an interesting programme with them. And that created a kind of halo effect over Asia. And then we thought, if we really want to achieve that holy grail of education and research partnerships, we talk about it all the time, and as you know, it's extraordinarily hard to deliver, because your natural education partnerships are not the same as your natural research partnerships often. But if you looked around the world, you said, look, in the post-war years, main source of international research was DARPA in the United States. The only country that was serious about scale of international research was China. So we went to China and we partnered with three of their double world first institutions, which until last week there were 42 of them, really their Russell group, their research intensives. Yeah. They've now spread it around a bit more, so there's now 193, I think, as of 191 as of last week.
Growth in China is just on a different level, isn't it?
But yeah. So we have Britain's only architecture program in China. Fascinating. It meant I was there in January 20 in Wuhan when the pandemic started. We'd done an enhanced risk assessment, but of course I came back with a cough. And so it took me 4 goes to persuade the NHS in Scotland to finally test me. They said, oh, you're just the worried well, but at least you've been there. So that's Wuhan. And that was an interesting experience because, of course, our Wuhan students knew what was coming. And it was extraordinarily hard for them to be in Britain in early 2020 when nobody was wearing masks, when people weren't taking it seriously, and they were in daily touch with their parents and their brothers and sisters. So that's one. We do. We have biomedical engineers in northern China who come. And then again, why was that right? Because biomedical engineers want to spend their final year in a really good NHS tertiary hospital, understanding how, you know, your ultrasound and your MRI is used. So that's our second. And our third is in the kind of classic areas of engineering. So that would be, I say, second. How do you create some really, really high class partnerships? That does create some risk of overexposure to certain geographies. So now, when partly because we are more financially stable as a result of the income we've raised, we're looking at sub-Saharan Africa and doing some really interesting things in sub-Saharan Africa where that is more about social impact and education. And the final thing I would say that we did was that we took humanitarian scholarships seriously. And we created a humanitarian scholarship program, which was linked to our revenue. So it grows all the time. And so we have just the amazing range of individuals from HESPAL, which is a higher education scheme for Palestine. I had dinner with our humanitarian scholars last week, one from the DCR who had spent his whole life since in UN refugee camps in Rwanda, having come out of the DRC, then went to the University of Rwanda and had the brilliance to sign up for. Now, you will know the University of Southern New Hampshire, which is the one that like Arizona really specializes yeah. online. So he did the joint online degree and then has come and spent time with us. And I literally Fantastic. Had lunch yesterday when I was on campus with one of our Afghan students. We obviously had last year, who's just arrived, we obviously had a number of Afghan offer holders last year, who some of them got over the border to Pakistan. They, of course, were intent on paying. That, of course, became impossible with the freezing of assets. And they are now one of our most recent humanitarian scholars with just amazing stories to tell. So 3 things. Make the campus global, recruiting lots of international students, and get your outward mobility right. Build some serious global partnerships and make sure that you have, you know, a humanitarian scholars program. Could in CARA, obviously, we had a vigil this week for Ukraine. We talked about our CARA scholars. We talked about the origin of CARA, how it was needed again, and that we all have Ukrainians next year coming on that program.
And I mean, I think that's a really coherent picture, but I think your balance between the, you know, those activities in terms of the global research partnerships, but international student recruitment more broadly, and the humanitarian thing, I think is a really good range of activity. On that final point then about your career, I mean, there is, you know, a real sense of universities wanting to do something to support, you know, both scholars and students fleeing the invasion of the Ukraine at the moment. And at the time we're talking, I mean, it's actually quite difficult, right? I mean, CARA are doing their best, as you say, but you know, our home office is not exactly throwing the doors open to enable us to welcome them here. So let's hope that does change. I'm not optimistic, but let's hope it does. But I think there are still real challenges in terms of then, you know, getting them all in. But I think every university wants to do it.
Yep. So look, we were really wrestling with this at our executive yesterday, and I'll just tell you where we end up. So look, we only have a handful from Ukraine, Belarus and Russia. But actually, we looked at the total number from surrounding countries and we're like at 500. So, you know, we're quite a small university, but we have 500 people who are in the Baltics, in Poland, all of that. But if you think, how do we support them? Because, of course, you know, we've had 2 weeks where, you know, the European Union has rightly said no visa required, just, you know, come. I even heard Ed Miliband on the radio this morning saying, you still need a visa. And I'm going, oh, damn it. So we have been lobbying really hard on this yeah. issue because, yeah. as you will know, I can't speak to English ones. I know the Scottish guidelines quite well. We met with the Scottish minister this week and he was saying, look, we have to be able to classify these as home students. And at the moment, the only people who we can give home student fee status to or that is advised is those who are either refugees or asylum seekers who have been granted asylum seeking status. Mm. Now, mm. if you are lost in the morass of the Home Office, there's no chance. So the obvious answer is just to decree, however long it takes Priti Patel to get her act together, the right thing for, as I say, the Scottish government says, we will just deem any Ukrainian national or any transfer student to be eligible for home fee status. And we're pushing quite hard in Scotland. Of course, home fee is funded. We're looking yeah. to it. But actually, when you think about this in granular terms, what went wrong with Afghanistan last year was it was the middle of August. And certainly in Scotland, we start in early September. We were yeah. robbed of time to figure it out. Yeah. We do have more time here. So actually, I was literally this morning writing a letter to all of our, you know, the students who could be impacted by this thing. Please apply now to our humanitarian scholarship scheme. The visa status will follow. My own view is Priti Patel's under so much pressure that there will end up being a Ukrainian visa status that we can then give contextual flags to, like we do for our humanitarian yeah. scholars, and let them in. So, but of course, there are difficult issues like they've only studied this year, a part year. What's the equivalency of their qualifications to ours? I mean, I was debating this with the medical dean this week. So the way we've resolved that is to say, look, we have a very well-established humanitarian scholar scheme. Please apply. Give us all your details, where you've come from, how much you've studied this year, what you're looking to transfer, what your credit is. And we accept that your visa status will be resolved further down the line, yeah. but we'll yeah. at least get things like the equivalency sorted yeah. out now. And I think if you have a scheme that you use for refugees, use that scheme and that process so that you can do, if you will, the university back office side yeah. of it whilst the visa issue is resolved. Because, yeah. of course, people yeah. can apply remotely. I mean, all of our humanitarian scholars, you know, apply all around the world. That is the joy of... Yeah. You know, we have a guy from Aleppo who's doing his doctorate, having traveled across, Greece, a boat, the Mediterranean, got to Germany, was working as a translator, saw the advert, applied, and has spent the last 2 years with us, married a Turkish local girl, they have a baby, all of that. And, you know, when you were looking at Mariupol this week, you say, we have Aleppo students studying with us who 4 years ago were yeah. going through that hell. You know, the power of the pen is stronger than the power of the sword. So so my advice to people is, yes, Priti Patel's a disaster area, but don't let that get in the way of getting our own house in order of things like what are we going to recognise in terms of credits? What are we going to do yeah. in terms of, you get it right down to granular level of individual applicants. We've got a trickle. It may become a flood. But again, our experience in Afghanistan, if you're trying to keep alive and discover where your family is, the truth is people don't come instantly. I think a lot of the intake will not be autumn 22. It will be January 23 and September 23.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. But that's really interesting experience drawing on the Syrian and Afghanistan cases. But I think part of the difficulty for the UK higher education sector is everyone wants to do something now, right? You know, they also want to be seen to be doing something, because there is a sense about, you know, actually wanting to show that you're really concerned and you really want to help out. But you're right. I mean, these things take time, right? And the key thing is to ensure that the roots are there for people whenever they might enter that pipeline, because it will take time.
Exactly. Get your transfer policy out now. You know, we have got an example of, I mean, Ukraine had 50,000 international students studying there, comparable to what yeah. Scotland has. 20,000 Indians, 8,000 Moroccans. Lots of those Indians will want to transfer into our medical schools. In some ways, sorting Priti Patel is the easy bit. You know, she either decrees her pen or not that they can study yeah, here. Yeah, we yeah, are the yeah. ones who need to figure out what's the equivalency, at what level do they come in? What can we do in terms of stipend support? Because even if the fee is waived, what's the level? And so there's quite a lot of back office work about yeah. recognition of prior learning for everyone who was a student in Ukraine. It's not new students. The 18-year-olds will wait a year. They'll get their time. The transfer students, it is things like equivalency and how you exercise contextual flags for disadvantage, which, as I say, we do for some of our humanitarian scholars and some of our home students. Just getting your act together to think all of that through feels to me where we can creatively put our energies.
Yeah, and every case is different, as you say. It does, but it does take time. But every story shows how it's worth investing the time in making this happen for people. You mentioned your trip to Wuhan earlier, right? But coming out of COVID, as it feels, there's still arguments about the extent to which that is actually true. But, you know, society has undoubtedly moved on. Right. And, there is a sense in which we are in a very different place to where we were 2 years ago. So as an institution, how have you, you know, we've all been on a bit of a roller coaster over the past couple of years. But how's Dundee coming out of it? I mean, is everything suddenly back to normal, or is it people struggling to come to terms with it in some areas? And how does it feel from your end?
OK, so two comments. One, let me talk about our big offshore activity. You know, we haven't been in China since January 20.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality looks like that Xi Jinping is not going to let people back in, or at least, I mean, it's 3 weeks in Shanghai. I can just about afford to go for 2 weeks and then work for a week. But, you know, if I rock up the vice chancellor and say, sorry, I'm out for the entirety of September in order to have 1 week in our three different GIs, I was wrestling with this issue yesterday with my team were. So, two things to say. One, we have really had to learn how to teach online to service our offshore students. And that is likely to go on. And we've learned a huge amount. One of the things we've done, is create a China services hub. So we set up a hub in China with kind of British-born Chinese who could speak the language, who sort out the IT. I mean, if you think about the number of different terms that we have for VPNs, that's a nightmare if you're kind of Chinese. So a lot of it was about language supporting country in the same time zone. So there is a duty of care that you cannot charge people the thick end of £20,000 and not have, you know, support available in the time zone in the right language, and we've done a lot of building of that, and that will remain, and that serves both what I would call open recruitment students and also in-country students. There's an offshore piece. There is, of course, a vastly larger acceptance of online learning than there ever was before. So there I was having discussions with both Nairobi and Kenya about dual degrees, where they've just changed their statutes in the last 6 months to recognise blended learning. None of that would have been possible before. So there are huge opportunities about equality in education and equality of access, because we all know how to make blended products work. So that is an arena of opportunity. Without being Pollyannish about it, that's a real arena of opportunity, although it takes time. Here, I mean, I am no expert in this, but I think I don't want to speak specifically to Dundee. I want to talk about what I observe more generally, which is, I think, and I'd be fascinated in your view, Paul, so to monologue for me, you tell me, I think the character of the student experience is changing out of all recognition in ways we don't understand. And that's actually one of the reasons why I work with THE on EdTech, because, look, I have two 16-year-old twins, boy and a girl. My son, having spent, you know, almost a year learning online over 2 years, he wouldn't dream of talking to a careers officer, and he certainly probably wouldn't even turn up to a webinar. He is interested, you know, TikTok is his frame of reference for what he's going to do with his life. And he wants an Amazon level of, you know, student services. So he doesn't want a nice lady in her 50s opposite him who's incredibly kind and kinder than his mother. Yeah, he wants an Amazon type service of 24-hour, and that is profound. I think it's also the case that people's social sets and bases of support and what they regard as home has changed. One of the things we are struggling with is, you know, how we do attendance monitoring. I mean, one of the things, and, you know, yes, it was a great idea to let students exit their accommodation early, but we used to believe that the reason students stayed till June or July was because they loved the student experience. In fact, the reality was that the halls of residence contract held them there. that is no longer the case. They can now go home at March, and we have to be more, you know, and come back to the exams and you know, I don't know if you ever lived in Pollock Halls at Edinburgh, but, you know, it's £9,000 a year. If you can save £3,000 by going home in March because you could break the contract, of course you're going to do it. And so the whole nature of student life has changed. I think the whole nature of student unions and student support have changed. I think, you know, for all of us of a certain age, it's about kind of representative type of democracy. That isn't the relationship that this generation of students have. But they live a much more virtual life. They retain much deeper links with where they've come from. They're not really interested in the representational. Many of them work incredibly. I mean, the affordability considerations have got so much more acute, both for domestic and international students, yeah, as a result of the pandemic. And I just think we are scratching the surface. I think we will move to, I think if you think of it from first principles, I think we thought a full-time face-to-face four-year experience is what people want. And actually, if money is no object, that's a fun thing to do. In Scotland, it's 4 years. England, it's two.
Yeah, yeah.
If money, roughly speaking, if there is a bank of mum and dad of some sort behind you, you will avail yourself of that. But for everyone for whom that's not the case, then they are much more interested in what's the return on investment of this vis-a-vis how I could spend my time. I'm going to prioritise my job. I'll study in my spare time. And maybe I could have a blended offer that allows me to study remotely, certainly for all of the arts, humanities, law, study remotely and be very occasionally in campus, that gives me mobility in where I'm located. And I think we need to think all of that through.
Yeah, and I think that in England, the government has started to think along those lines of the lifelong learning entitlement, which is actually, you know, the idea of it is a good one. It's incredibly complicated to actually make it work, but, you know, they're on the journey. And I think that does speak to that point that you just described. I do think you're right. And I mean, there is a you know, the kind of coming out of COVID issue. Everyone's had a difficult experience of one kind or another. You know, there's a generation of, you know, kids coming through to university who will have very different expectations. And it's become polarized in, you know, in government and the media as a kind of face-to-face versus online thing, one good, one bad. It's very, very different from that. It's much more nuanced. And the challenge for universities, I think, is to try and adapt the range of provision that we have to suit the individual, right? Recognizing that everyone is going to be different. The thing that worries, I mean, you made a very good point about student unions, and I think that's absolutely right. But the thing that, you know, kind of has been noticeable for me is that those kind of cohesive structures around student unions, societies, you know, cultural, political, sporting, right? They've broken down quite a lot as well over the
time. Right?
And they need to be built back up, because actually students do need ways of getting together to share their interests and understand that you can have a common purpose and do things better together than you do on your own. Because that sense of belonging, however tenuous, to an institution or to a course or to a hall or to society, is just so important to enable them to get the most out of that experience. But you're right, it's very, very already very different and much more diverse and fragmented than it's ever been before. And I think that's a huge challenge for us.
I agree, because I think, you know, students want the best of both worlds. So they want the lectures to be face-to-face 5 days a week, but they want to choose what 3 days they come onto campus. So they absolutely insist that you also have, you know, available to watch asynchronously for them. And that's tough, you know, even just making sure that every single lecture theatre is, you know, geared up for dual mode. So that, I think, is true. And I think, coming back to students, I agree, we are trying to nurture student life. And I give you an example. We had a huge influx of Sri Lankan students, which, you know, we used to have a handful. This, of course, because the Southern Hemisphere was closed. They didn't have any student society, so we had no one to talk to. So we, you know, we hosted like a huge curry evening for them in the students' union. And it was better attended than any of the ones where we had an established society, because they needed that point, that opportunity to build connection. And I think we've outsourced quite a lot. I mean, I totally believe in peer-to-peer, but I think we've outsourced quite a lot of student services and delivery to our students' unions. And I think we need to have a slightly more honest discussion with them about what service are they able to provide? What does the university need to to nurture it. There's a lot of building back to come.
Yeah, and we undoubtedly have to invest more. One final point, because we've got to wrap up soon, Wendy, is you mentioned right at the beginning, you know, your experience in the Scottish Parliament and also looking over the Canadian experience in Quebec, right? And independence is one thing, but there is obviously, historically, there has been a divergence between, you know, the nations in the UK. And, you know, Scotland has had a long independent tradition of higher education as well, which is, in a sense has defined higher education for large parts of the Western world as well, particularly the US. But in terms of the way things are going, I mean, do we see a continued divergence of all levels of, you know, kind of regulatory and funding and political activity as well, or will it kind of slow down? What's your thinking on that?
It's interesting. I hope it's more nuanced than just a kind of one-way movement to more divergence, because actually the student experience and challenges are very similar. So I think, you know, in China, they see a global, they see a British higher education brand. All of us benefit from that Oxbridge halo effect into which Scotland is nested. So one of the most interesting things, but Scotland's much smaller. So if you look at Sweden, they have a kind of, if you go onto the study in Sweden, they've got a real values-based pitch. So one of the things I've tried to do is hire students and say, look, we can have a values-based pitch in Scotland, but if you've got 160 institutions in the UK, that doesn't make sense. The proposition is going to be much more about student experience, employability, global reach, English. So my own view is that most Scottish institutions feel they are nested within a British brand, certainly globally. I think, there's a big debate at the moment about whether we'll participate in the new TEF. We did in the old one. I think maybe we won't in the new one, partly because of how some of the measures are constructed. But I also think that's a pity. How do people get comparators? The league tables certainly remain, UK-wide. To answer your question, I don't think it's a one-way street. I give an example, obviously, you know, post-Brexit, the government finally began to care about international education. They appointed Steve Smith as an international education champion. We have so few global assets. Probably you're a big football person, so beyond the Premier League or culture, you know, there is only higher education. And so, you know, so I'm going with Steve Smith to Nigeria, where we're doing girls education in TNE in April, if all these risk assessments allow us.
Fantastic.
So I think we are kind of, I think there is a nesting. There will be points of divergence, but there will also be points of connection, and we should, you know, we should seek to preserve that.
Oh, that's really great to hear, because I do think it is really important that we do have that, you know, that British higher education brand as well. We are a diverse sector, right? You know, we don't need to force greater diversity where it's not necessary, just for, you know, political ends. But let's not go there. Wendy, we need to stop that. Listen, thank you ever so much for the conversation. Really do appreciate it. It's been great to catch up. And thanks ever so much.
Thank you, Paul. Great to reconnect.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.